It's really about how do you even begin the process of engagement, because we're dealing with a new leader in North Korea that no one's ever engaged with.
North Korea is again invited for talks. It's Thursday, December 14th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Be sure to join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China marks a solemn anniversary. Families of North Korean abductees still seek loved ones. Philippines martial law extended. Marijuana legally making a profit and using pot to help pets. It's all on today's VOA Asia. UN Undersecretary for Political Affairs Jeffrey Feltman told reporters in New York his talks in Pyongyang last week with senior North Korean officials found common ground on the need to prevent war over its nuclear and missile programs, but little else.
North Korean interlocutors agreed it was important to prevent war. How we do that was the topic of 15-plus hours of discussions. The people who we met listened carefully to our arguments. They explored our thinking. They asked questions. They argued with us. But ultimately, they have to take what we said and talk about it internally, talk about it with their leadership. So that's why I'm reluctant to say now what is the impact of our visit, because they need time to digest and consider how they will respond to our message.
Feltman said he believes the door to a diplomatic solution has been left ajar and hopes the door to a diplomatic solution will be opened wide. He told them the international community is committed to a peaceful solution, but united in opposition to North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons. His views came the same day that U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson offered an apparent change in policy of holding talks with the North without precondition.
We've said from the diplomatic side, we're ready to talk anytime North Korea would like to talk. And we're ready to have the first meeting without precondition. Let's just meet. We can talk about the weather if you want. We talk about whether it's going to be a square table or a round table, if that's what you're excited about. But can we at least sit down and see each other face to face? And then we can begin to lay out a map, a roadmap, of what we might be willing to work towards. It's not realistic to say we're only going to talk if you come to the table ready to give up your program. They have too much invested in it. And the president is very realistic about that as well. And so it's really about how do you even begin the process of engagement, because we're dealing with a new leader in North Korea that no one's ever engaged with.
Tillerson said the United States will not tolerate a nuclear-armed North Korea, but he said such talks could be held after a period of quiet without nuclear or missile testing. It is unclear whether President Donald Trump, who has said talking with North Korea would be a waste of time, gave his approval to the speech to the Atlantic Council think tank. But Korea Society Senior Director of Policy Stephen Norper tells VOA's Victor Beatty such a position is long overdue and a step forward in easing tensions.
For the United States to basically be in the position of saying that it's willing to come to the table and talk without those preconditions on North Korea means that negotiations much more likely. The prior situation, less so if it meant that they had to give that up as part of the precondition to come to the table. At this point, the United States is saying, come and we'll talk from there.
He also mentioned that North Korea must show restraint. Quote, it's going to be tough to talk if in the middle of our talks, North Korea decides to test another device. So we continue to indicate to them that we need a period of quiet. You need to tell us you want to talk. North Korea has indicated it's not interested in talking, is it?
North Korea has held off on some of its testing up until the November 29th test. There had been almost a 75-day hiatus, and so Washington is signaling that it wants to see a similar type of pause in missile and nuclear activity to show seriousness to get to the table to negotiate.
Tillerson disclosed that the U.S. has been in discussions with China about how to secure North Korea's nuclear weapons in the event the government collapses.
Well, I think what he's trying to do is signal a few things. He's saying that there's muscle behind the diplomacy. So he reiterated that the U.S. has military capabilities. He noted that there is the opportunity to step up sanctions even further, and he noted that there's been this conversation with China over the nuclear stockpile issue, and that the U.S., if it went forward, would then go back beyond the 38th parallel into South Korean territory to provide China some sort of security assurance. And all of that is designed to signal to North Korea that the U.S. is dealing with a portfolio of options, but it appears that negotiation now is certainly at the fore, and a more realistic thing to be talking about today.
With regard to a dialogue without precondition, do you think President Trump backs that view?
I wouldn't be the person to answer that. Secretary Tillerson and President Trump are the only two people who know that answer, but one would assume with such a public address that Secretary Tillerson was going out and making an advance for negotiation, and one would assume that's coordinated with the White House.
Stephen Norper said Jeffrey Feltman's visit to North Korea, the first by a senior UN diplomat since 2011, provides an opening to a potential mediation role because Feltman met with Foreign Minister Ri Hong-yo, who Norper said has the ear of leader Kim Jong-un. Ahead of the Tillerson speech, Kim announced plans to develop more nuclear weapons and decorated those involved in developing the latest intercontinental ballistic missile. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. China welcomes U.S. offer to hold talks with North Korea without preconditions. North Korean abductees remain victims of nuclear standoff. Philippine Congress extends martial law in troubled South for 1 year. Rescued child sex workers in India reveal hidden cells in brothels. China observes landmark anniversary of Nanjing massacre. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Chinese President Xi Jinping joined thousands of others Wednesday to mark the 80th anniversary of the beginning of weeks of Japanese military atrocities committed during what China calls the Nanjing Massacre, also known as the Rape of Nanking, a city in eastern China. A siren wailed during a moment of silence for the victims of the brutal attacks that began December 13, 1937. President Xi Jinping said the Japanese invaders perpetuated an extremely brutal massacre. The whole city was reduced to ruins, leaving a dark page in human history. But he called on Japan to join China in using history as a mirror to pursue peaceful and friendly cooperation. The day is now known as a National Day of Remembrance in China, and the event was carried live on state television. Jeff Kingston is an Asia Studies professor at Temple University in Tokyo. He tells VOA it is remarkable how little reconciliation there has been between these two rivals over this shared history.
Still in Japan, there are many who are in denial that it happened, question whether in fact the Japanese armed forces did commit the atrocities that are well-evidenced. And this is a problem, I think, in bilateral relations overall, that the two countries have not really come to a meeting of minds over that tragic history.
Kingston explains why the Japanese forces committed the atrocity.
The Japanese forces were coming from a very bloody battle in Shanghai. Through the entire invasion from the coast into Nanjing, Japanese troops pursued a scorched earth policy. And I think partly this was for vengeance, but also to demonstrate to the Chinese people what would be the costs of continuing their resistance. So I think there was Japanese hope for a very quick victory in China. They hoped that this would be a shock and awe strategy. And what they didn't count on, I think, is producing such a unifying, strong backlash by the Chinese people. So what the Japanese did in Nanjing was horrific. I mean, massive rapes, killings, lootings, and burnings. It's remarkable today that many Japanese revisionist historians, and including the Prime Minister, downplay or deny what actually happened. And I think this will remain a part of the permafrost in bilateral relations. So in recent months, there have been signs of a thaw in bilateral relations, and the two nations trying to embrace a forward-looking bilateral relationship. But I think that the unresolved grievances of the past will continue to reverberate in very powerful ways that will impede significant progress in bilateral relations.
Jeff Kingston said Chinese Communist authorities used such historical events to shore up party legitimacy, even though it did little to fight Japanese occupation and as leverage against Japan in maritime disputes, as well as diverting public attention away from issues that plague Chinese society, such as corruption and the environment. Meanwhile, the History Channel aired a docudrama in the United States and China Wednesday called The Scars of Nanjing, based on the reflections of a handful of foreigners, including American missionaries, who stayed behind and witnessed the atrocities. Happening now in Asia, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has won legislative approval to extend martial law for a year in the southern Mindanao region, which was besieged by Islamic militants earlier this year. This story and more are on VOA 60 Online. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very happy you've taken time to join us on VOA Asia. Families of North Korean abductees feel forgotten by the world, despite the increased international focus on widespread North Korean human rights abuses that a United Nations report described as on a scale unparalleled in the modern world. After the 1950 to 1953 Korean War, North Korea returned most prisoners of war, but reportedly forced thousands of South Korean citizens to remain to help rebuild national industries, schools, and other basic state functions. In the decades after, thousands more were reportedly abducted by North Korea. Most of them were fishermen who were purportedly taken to gain intelligence or serve some propaganda purpose in the ongoing inter-Korean Cold War. More than 500 Korean victims are still being held in the North, and of that number, 300 are more than 70 years old. These abduction cases remain unresolved as escalating inter-Korean tensions over the North's nuclear program have blocked any cooperation on humanitarian issues. North Korea also stands accused of abducting a number of Japanese and other foreign nationals in the 1970s and 1980s, reportedly to train North Korean spies. An agreement between Japan and North Korea to ease some sanctions in exchange for an investigation into the status of abduction victims has since fallen apart over Pyongyang's lack of cooperation and its continued testing of nuclear weapons. Phil Robertson is Deputy Director in Asia for Human Rights Watch.
I think there was a brief opening, there was a brief ray of sunshine that came in on this issue with Charles Jenkins and others being able to get out and being able to say what they knew. And then the door slammed shut. The curtains were drawn, and there's been nothing further.
Robertson said North Korea is now in complete denial in the case of abductions of foreign nationals, and he has called on the international community to speak out strongly and increase pressure on the Kim Jong-un government to release abductees, hold those responsible for the abductions accountable, and improve human rights conditions in the country.
There are crimes against humanity that have to be answered for by North Korea. So, you know, speaking quietly is not an option at this point.
The United Nations Security Council also met this week to discuss a General Assembly recommendation to refer North Korea to the International Criminal Court for Crimes Against Humanity, based on a 2014 Commission of Inquiry report documenting a network of political prison camps and systematic human rights abuses, including murder, enslavement, torture, rape, and other sexual violence. China, North Korea's key ally on the Security Council, has blocked any further action on the measure. North Korea's permanent mission to the United Nations has called the allegations of human rights violations fictitious. Our thanks to VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Padden and Yeomi Kim for sending us this report. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia: fire in a southern neighborhood of Beijing, China has killed 5 people and injured 8 more. It came just weeks after another deadly blaze in the city prompted a crackdown against migrant workers, sparking widespread anger. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, martial law declared in the southern Philippines over much of the year has had little impact on most people in the area, reducing any anxiety about a proposal to renew it in 2018. Despite fears that martial law declared over the island of Mindanao in May would follow the harsher measures taken by authoritarian former President Ferdinand Marcos in 1972, people on the island say little has changed outside a single city where troops were fighting a group of armed Muslim rebels. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte ordered martial law through December 31st so troops and police could bypass legal procedures in capturing suspected supporters of the Islamic State-inspired Maute group in Marawi City. The fighting ended in October with over 1,000 dead, but the president is seeking an extension in 2018 as violence flares up on another part of the ever-restive island. Local residents and analysts say extension of the law that gives local authorities the ability to declare curfews, skirt due process, and set up road checkpoints is unlikely to stir fear in people outside of the conflict zones. So far, a lot of common Mindanao inhabitants see just an occasional checkpoint. Oscar Moreno is a city mayor on Mindanao Island.
It's a different martial law compared to the martial law that was imposed in 1972. There are safeguards in the Constitution that have certainly been introduced because of the lessons of the 1972 martial law. So martial law, as it is universally understood, may not necessarily apply here in the city or here in the province or here in Mindanao, or here in the whole country.
They don't need a lot of fighters to create havoc. They just have to hold hostage one big mall for a few days, and then that could do a lot of damage psychologically to the country. So I think the military and Duterte know something that the rest of the world, the rest of the Philippines doesn't know.
Martial law under Marcos called for curfews, bans on public assembly, and military arrests of people such as communist insurgents who were suspected of plotting to undermine the government. Marcos was afraid then that the government could be toppled. Since 1987, the Philippine Constitution has set limits on martial law, including sign-off by legislators, in some cases, the Supreme Court. Martial law cannot suspend the Constitution. Officials must prove evidence of rebellion to justify martial law, but may have found one December 3rd. That day, a Muslim rebel group killed two civilians. The news website Rappler.com reports Duterte suspects Islamic State may be supporting those fighters to establish a caliphate. Eduardo Arrual, associate professor at the National University of Singapore's Public Policy School, says it is well known rebels are gathering forces.
They don't need a lot of fighters to create havoc. They just have to hold hostage one big mall for a few days, and then that could do a lot of damage psychologically to the country. So I think the military and Duterte know something that the rest of the world, the rest of the Philippines doesn't know.
The news website DavaoToday.com says in Mindanao this year, the armed forces of the Philippines had to set up about 17,500 road checkpoints on the island, established curfews in 129 population centers, and deployed some 9,700 people to public patrol spaces by June. But on a recent night in Moreno City's population of 675,000 people, residents there were shopping around dusk at a sprawling two-story mall. A group laughed and shared mobile phone content over pizza just outside, and across the street, a hotel lobby bar was filled with business people, nobody apparently mentioning curfews. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. This news alert from VOA Asia, Toyota Motor Corporation and Panasonic Corporation have announced they are considering a joint development of batteries for electric vehicles, building on an existing agreement Panasonic has to manufacture batteries for Toyota vehicles. Power your way through the day with the latest stories on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, it's a trend worth noting. Some entrepreneurs who made their money in the tech field are now looking to profit in the marijuana industry. VOA's Kevin Enix reports on the booming industry growing up around pot.
Eric Escala was a senior manager for Apple. Now he spends his days making marijuana-infused chocolate. It's a big change, but a good one for him.
Being born in the Bay Area, you know, you're surrounded by software and tech, and, you know, kids that you played with on the playground are now like engineers over at Facebook or Google. I like the tangibleness of just making products. Like, I think at the end of the day, I'm a person that just loves just creating products. And with cannabis, it gave us the opportunity to be able to do that.
Alan Gartner left the tech world to open the Tokyo Smoke Shop in Toronto, Canada, creating accessories for pot smokers.
I worked for Google in California, the headquarters, for 3 years in corporate strategy. And then I spent 3 years across Asia running a business unit. And I turned 30. I'd been at Google longer than anything else I'd done in my entire life. And I was looking for something different.
But it was more than just a different job. The pot world, like the tech world, is a great place for an entrepreneur to make money.
Because of the opportunity, this will likely be the only time in my life that I see such a large-scale market move from the black market into the legal market. Consumers are already consuming cannabis. Here's this incredible moment where all around the world, the cannabis revolution will happen within the next 10 years.
Only 8 U.S. states have legalized recreational marijuana use. It's not yet legal in Canada, though the nation is on track to legalize it in 2018. And many people still see pot as a dangerous drug.
Cannabis is still one of those taboos. And, you know, having that conversation with my mom, who is not only Asian, but also very Catholic, and grew up in a generation where cannabis was considered just as bad as, you know, any other drug, Schedule I drug. It was kind of a hard conversation to have, or I thought I was gonna have, but she actually was really open to the idea, and she actually eats the product on a regular basis.
So, despite some misgivings, the legal cannabis market is currently worth about $8 billion. And is expected to hit $22 billion by 2021. That's a lot of money for a product that was only legalized for recreational use in the U.S. 5 years ago. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Medical marijuana has been used to treat epilepsy in patients for years, and this month, U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams said it should be studied and treated like other pain relief drugs. A growing body of scientific evidence is leading the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to do that. Meanwhile, researchers at Colorado State University are examining the benefits of cannabidiol, a non-psychoactive byproduct of marijuana. VOA's Faith Lapidus tells us the byproduct is being used to treat dogs with epilepsy and arthritis.
Lester's really good about taking medicine because
just like people, dogs can suffer from epilepsy. Craig Adams remembers the horrifying night his dog Buster collapsed.
Buster on the first seizure did not start screaming, but you know, the mouth shakes, and they shake violently.
Adams turned to cannabis to try to relieve Buster's symptoms and saw instant results.
Yeah. Within about 45 minutes after giving it to Buster, I could see a difference. It was just a whole different dog.
Buster is one of about 4 dozen dogs taking part in a Colorado State University study of CBD, or cannabidiol, a substance derived from hemp without the euphoria-producing THC found in marijuana. Researchers first checked the dogs' brains for deformities to ensure there are none that could be an underlying cause of seizures, and the owners keep a daily log of any seizures their pets have. To check for arthritis, researchers measure how much weight is placed on each paw when the dog walks across a specially developed pad.
When they put less pressure on the paw, then that means that they're more painful.
During the 12-week study, each dog will get CBD oil for 6 weeks and a placebo for 6 weeks. Researchers are cataloging dosage, oil application, side effects, and how to counteract those side effects.
The overall goal, the really long-term goal, would be to translate it to human medicine.
Results of the study are expected next year. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. There are many ways you can hear our program, but of course, we think one of the most fun ways is to hear it on the radio. If you happen to be in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, check us out on Helps Radio at Help University. We thank everyone there who is listening today and wherever you happen to be listening to VOA Asia. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Dave Magnus, managing editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, David Bird, and Skylar Ogden on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.